KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and thank you for listening to KZSU. Today I'm very excited and indeed honored to have on Professor Jonathan Zittrain, author of the new book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, a quite provocative book that, in fact, at least in certain versions I saw, it had anything from in terms of the cover, from a hand over a face to train tracks going off the edge of a cliff. Quite a provocative title, quite a provocative cover. And what it really is doing in Professor Zittrain's most recent book is taking a close look at the question of what we're doing with the internet itself and how it operates. And in fact, where we are today from the standpoint of the basic question of whether we're going to have the internet that we want, which we'll be talking about in the future. In this book, Jonathan takes a close look at the various technologies that make up the internet and in the values that are also incorporated there. We spent a fair amount of time on Hearsay Culture discussing the values inherent in the internet, and those values are debatable. And we've discussed also the history of the internet and how it's developed. In this book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, which is being published by Yale University Press, the question ultimately presented is whether the internet is teetering on a precipice. And if it is teetering on a precipice, what are we going to do about it? What are the options? What are the potential outcomes of choosing one option or another? And where are we left if we choose an option that may or may not be the option that we would like to see in the internet, i.e., closing down technologies, i.e., making security paramount, and other types of basic fundamental questions that we have to think about in terms of our future using technology, but also in terms of how we want the internet to look and operate. By way of very brief background, Jonathan is the professor of internet governance and regulation at Oxford University and is also co-founder of Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. I have not had the pleasure of meeting Professor Zittrain in person. However, certainly we've crossed paths in the figurative sense, given my affiliation with the Center for Internet and Society and Professor Zittrain's longstanding relationship with Professor Larry Lessig at Stanford. So without any further introduction, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and taking time out of your schedule.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start right off with a basic question. And while many of the listeners may be familiar with you, for those that aren't familiar, your general background and why you chose to write this book.
Well, I guess I was a nerd first and a law type later. I signed on to CompuServe as a teenager, the CompuServe Information Service, one of the proprietary walled garden services of the 1980s, mm-hmm. When the internet was still very much off in a corner and not available to rank-and-file consumers. And it cost either $6 or $12 an hour, depending on time of day and modem speed. And I loved it. I thought it was great to be able to meet new people through the service, and joined a forum for Texas Instruments computers, which was my brand of computer, the TI-99-4A, all of 16K of RAM. And after about 6 weeks, the bill came in, which went to my parents, and they told me that whatever was going on had to stop. And I was lucky enough to be offered an assistant sysop ship, a chance to help out around the TI forum, in exchange for free time. And that was sort of my first real exposure to some of the issues that come up in online communities. I later became a sysop system operator of the sysop forum, the forum privately on CompuServe, where the managers of all the forums got together to talk about how to run a forum. And it was from that personal vantage point that I saw, as the 90s rolled around, the invasion of the internet and the fact that basically no one, not the CompuServe executives, not the sysops, not the subscribers, saw it coming. They thought they were competing against the Source and Prodigy and AOL. They had no idea that this competing network, wildly different in architecture, in ethos, in business plan, would be going up against it.
Well, from an early Prodigy user to a CopyServ user, it's good to see that we've finally bridged those gaps. The world of the internet obviously differs from the world that you described. And certainly, again, many listeners may be familiar with SysOps, but perhaps you could describe that world that you described with CopyServ. What were its basic elements, and at least at a top level, how does it differ from the internet itself?
Well, the most important elements of it were that when you paid your money by the hour, you were paying it to a firm that was responsible not just for your network connectivity, but for having it be an enjoyable experience worth the hourly rate or more. And that meant that, say, CompuServe saw itself as grooming an information service where it was responsible for it. It was even more control than you would say a mall owner has over a mall. And they wanted to be attractive. They invested in content. They would forge partnerships with, say, Associated Press, so you could get AP News and read that for your hourly fee. But if there were any innovation to take place from among the users, that was much more difficult to channel to fellow users. CompuServe ran on big mainframes, modified Deck 10s, but if you wanted to write new code for it, it was not easy to make it so that other people on the network could run that new code themselves and get some new game or new facility or who knows what. All of it funneled through CompuServe. And I think, really, it was hard for them to imagine it being any other way. And the internet, on the other hand, was forged by people who had severely much more tight constraint in the sense that they had no money. They had no money to invest, not in content, but even in networks. They had a little bit of government grants just to pay them. And then they saw their role as basically designing protocols that would allow existing networks to interoperate with one another. And in that sense, when you plug into CompuServe, you get a main menu. When you plug into the internet, you get the equivalent of a blinking cursor. There's no main menu. There's no CEO. There's no business plan. And in that sense, I also think the framers of the internet were liberated. They didn't have any money, but they also didn't have to make any money, which meant they didn't have to persuade anybody that their ideas were good, that there would be some audience for it. There was just none of that. It was just, hey, let's just experiment. We're just playing around with it. And it really hasn't changed significantly in the most important fundamental respects since that experimentation started. And I think of it as one of the happiest ironies of the modern information revolution, that a network with no content, with no content plans, with no investment in content, and with no active management, became far more interesting, had far more content, far more innovation taking place than the commercial networks where people's bets were placed.
Before we get into some of the substance of your book, I think framing the discussion is helpful. And we're familiar with phrases that have become cliches, like information wants to be free. And we're generally familiar with some of these core values that the quote-unquote founders of the internet encompassed, like access to information generally and having packets of information spread through the internet without any form of seniority or preferential treatment. We're going to be talking about net neutrality a little bit later in the discussion, but I kind of want to just get your general reaction or your thoughts on what the real values were of the founders of the internet. Is that articulation, and I know I've said it very generally, a generally accurate statement, or what's your sense? Because that's certainly something that is still, in some measure, debated among people, especially when we think about regulation on the internet and some of the other issues we're going to be discussing shortly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure the framers shared a common mind any more than the framers of the U.S. Constitution did when they drafted it. Of course, the framers of the U.S. Constitution knew that they were undertaking a political act and framing a new nation, whereas the framers of the internet, framers word notwithstanding, were messing around. They were experimenting with protocols. Now, I think the protocols they chose and the design that they came up with reflected their ethos. A lot of it might have been implicit ethos. I don't think they were raging civil libertarians when they happened to design a system that made individual identity far more difficult to ascertain than on one of the pay networks like CompuServe. Instead, I think it just reflected the varying constraints and realities, so that CompuServe, in order to send somebody a bill and know how many minutes they spent, had to be able to identify each and every subscriber and know them uniquely. Whereas on the internet, if you don't need a billing model, if you're not trying to charge them money, who cares who they are? Who cares where they are? Who cares how many of them there are? Mm-hmm. There's no reason to leap into doing that. That's a hacking exercise left to another time. And so in some ways, I think it's less a grand strategic plan that certain features of the internet turned out the way they did, and in fact turned out to be as innovation-friendly as they have been, than it was just a natural reflection of the non-grabbiness of the framers. They weren't out at any point to proprietize or monopolize what they had, and that just meant the default position was, if somebody's going to come up with a new service on the internet, of course, like, why would we go to the trouble of designing an infrastructure for some central authority to vet it? Mm-hmm. They want to ship bits, let them ship bits, you know? That's nothing to us. That's more power to them. And in that sense, I think the ethos was more implicit. Now, you're right that in later times, some of the engineering statements about the net, including the idea of so-called end-to-end neutrality, which in very short is that the network's job should be to route the bits and not to peer at them, not to treat them differently, not to get too clever about it, just route the bits. That was articulated in a 1981 or 1983 paper, depending on which version you look at, by Salzer, Reed, and Clark, three of the real big internet engineers. And that was it was put out as solely an engineering argument. It was not a political argument. It was saying, if you want the network to work well, generally it's better to keep the features at the endpoints and not try to make the network in the middle very smart. That later, in the late 1990s, early 21st century, was transformed into a political argument that says it would be wrong to have the network filter in the middle, not because it might go a little slower or be less efficient or something, but because it would be wrong.
With that background, we can move towards your book a little bit, and perhaps I will come up with the basic question, which ultimately boils down to thesis or theses. To start at the very top level with a very general question, what are they?
Well, there are several, which makes it tough to put on a bumper sticker, but I'll give you the overall sweep of the argument. And you opened the discussion with talking about the cover and covers of the book. For the American edition of the book, we actually rejected two covers that Yale University Press had suggested, one of which was a hand saying stop, which was a particularly infelicitous cover because I have a co-authored book that has come out the same month called Access Denied, yes, about internet filtering around the world, for which the cover is a hand saying stop. It just seemed wrong to have two books come out the same month with hand saying stop. So we put it out to an internet contest, and a guy named Ivo van der Int in the Netherlands won, and I worked with him to take his original idea of a single set of train tracks going over a cliff to one in which the tracks fork. Mm-hmm. And there's an opportunity to go in one direction or another. And I should add that neither direction shows you what you get on the other side.
Yes.
So it's possible that going over the cliff is better than turning to the right. The basic thesis of the book is that a lot of the technological medium in which we swim in modern consumer IT, both the internet as we've discussed it versus the proprietary networks, and the PC as we haven't really discussed it yet, the generic reprogrammable personal computer, versus a number of information appliances that we have safely forgotten, like the Brother smart word processor, where, you know, you buy the object, its job is to do word processing, and that's it. That these technologies, PC and internet, are amazing engines of innovation, but that as they have hit the mainstream, they start to get a natural ceiling because their very popularity makes it worth it to exploit them and to subvert them and their users. that once there are enough eyeballs looking at email and they're not all nerds who don't get out much or spend much, now you have a justification to send spam. Mm-hmm. Once you have tons of machines running that are generically reprogrammable and they're on good bandwidth with good processing speed, you then can see how users, it's worth it to reprogram their machines at a distance and get them to attack other machines or send spam or slurp the personal data there. And all of those phenomena to me are phenomena that are the price of success. And one of the themes of the book is if we don't deal with the problems that arise from success, people will actually start abandoning these generative platforms. And by generative, I mean capable of being changed and built upon by third parties. Hmm. And a lot of people reacting to the thesis don't fully believe it. They argue against it. They say that, you know, maybe we'll retreat a little bit to a range of appliances. I talk a bit about information appliances and their return in things like the iPhone and the iPod. But they say, you know, people will still keep their PCs on the one hand, and then they'll have iPods too. I'm not at all confident of that. I think more and more we tend to believe that if you give me a browser, you've given me the world. And if I can get a browser on my iPhone, I'm basically able to do everything I want to do. I think that's a dangerous path to go down, in part because the browser is but one application on the Internet. And if we start thinking of the web as everything, then a whole range of new applications that have just gotten started, including peer-to-peer, may fall by the wayside because we won't have the reprogrammable hardware to try them out.
The there's some interesting literature and writing in this area, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that looks at ultimately the question or the issue that we view the Internet in the traditional form of the page and text, and that in and of itself, in other words, the analogy to the book, is somewhat limiting. What's your view of that in terms of how we conceptualize the Internet itself?
Well, part of it is the interchangeability with which many people think of Internet and web. That's a great example of people thinking that all there is to the Internet is the web. And then you point out that when you're using an instant messenger client or your picture frame is getting updated on pictures, it may not be a web experience at all. People are like, oh, I see. There's all sorts of things you could do with a generic network that routes bits from one person to another that may not entail the World Wide Web. I'm also amazed that the web itself came as innovation from just some guy. Tim Berners-Lee, physicist, comes up with the protocol, sets it up. It's just an experiment. It's just in a backwater. Set up a website if you feel like it. And suddenly it becomes, you know, the Internet, as far as many people are concerned. That's a great example of a generative success that I celebrate, but that if the technologies were as limited then as I say they are becoming now, in other words, you couldn't easily install a web browser, this weird thing called a web browser, on your PC, then the web might not ever have taken off. And you're right that the web assumes something about pages and page views and reloading, and it's only been recently, the so-called rise of Web 2.0, mm-hmm. in the sense of very clever technologies like the ones that let you grasp a Google map and move it around as if it were, you know, on your own PC. Those kinds of technologies are starting to make the browser feel more generic and feel more powerful, but it still means that most of the programming action is happening elsewhere, and the makers of the platforms that give you things like Google Maps are very much more powerful than the old operating system vendors, including the famously proprietary Bill Gates.
With that general overview, perhaps we can jump forward and then try to fill in some of the analysis. Of course, we have a limited amount of time, so we can only really get tip of the iceberg. But starting with the basics, how would you describe the state of affairs in 2008? Now, we're recording the show on April 28th. What do you see as the values currently encompassed in the Internet?
Well, maybe one way to get at that is as concrete as possible, now that we've truly dated the show,
yes.
is to look at the iPhone. Mm-hmm. I see Steve Jobs and the trajectory that he's gone through personally and professionally as a pretty good handle on the overall trajectory that I'm worried about. In 1977 was a 21-year-old Steve Jobs who gave us the Apple II personal computer, the first blinking cursor, totally reprogrammable computer for which Steve Jobs did not care what you did with it as long as you bought it. And that level of ignorance and, hey, you know, whatever will happen, was really brought home when 2 years later, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston invented VisiCalc, the first computer spreadsheet ever. Hmm. Businesses loved it. They wanted it, which meant they needed Apple IIs. So Apple IIs start flying off the shelves, and Apple has no idea why. The company actually has to do market research to figure out why the thing is so popular. That, to me, is a great slice of time representing the experimentalist spirit and the generative spirit that both infused the internet and the PC in its early days. You fast forward a little bit to 1984, and it's the introduction of the Macintosh. Still a generically reprogrammable personal computer, but one for which many of the rough edges have been sanded off. You turn the thing on and it smiles at you. Gorgeous graphical user interface. The beginning of starting to bundling some stuff with it, so you buy it and you get Mac Paint and Mac Write. It relies less on third-party software. And for peripherals and such, Apple is trying to kind of corner the market on that. They figure they know what you'll want. Here's the Image Writer, here's the Image Writer 2 kind of thing. Less open, in many ways, to third parties cooking up hardware and peripherals. Then you fast forward to 2006, and Jobs introduces the iPhone, and he says this thing is not going to run outside code. It's as gorgeous as the Mac, even more so, but it will not allow third parties to change it because we don't want it to be like a PC. You load three apps on your PC, it crashes. The iPhone needs to work and be simple and be cool. And that's the 21st century ethos. And I love the iPhone as an object, as a functionality, but I also see the extent to which Jobs' refusal to allow any outside code to run on it could be a harbinger of things to come. Now, April 2008, Steve Jobs says, okay, we see that third parties are so anxious to code for this phone that they were willing to write software to run on it against an outright ban. And users were using stuff called jailbreak to get the phone to run it at risk of bricking the phone, that it would phone home to Apple, and by sure accident, the phone would get killed. Mm-hmm. And that level of passion we must recognize, so they now announce the Software Developers Kit. But if you look at how the software development kit is shaping up, it is what I call contingently generative. People who write software for the iPhone have to have it vetted by Steve Jobs. He says whether or not he's going to let it run on the phone. You can't just walk up to somebody with an iPhone and give them the software to run on it. There's no card or floppy disk you're supposed to be able to give them. It all has to go through the iPhone apps store. Steve Jobs takes a cut of anything you sell, and if you sell it for nothing, he takes a cut of nothing. But again, he reserves the right to prospectively, at the time you submit it, or retroactively, kill any app he doesn't like, which also means a regulator could tell him to kill an app that isn't desirable. And I'm worried that that could be the worst of both worlds, that it's programmable enough to be a really attractive platform, but exactly around the edges where new applications could come out that are so new and transformative that they offend or scare somebody, including just an incumbent who sees competition, that's exactly when the thing can get killed because a switch can be thrown to kill it.
The book is The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, the author, Professor Jonathan Zittrain. Jonathan, let's take a very short break here, and then when I come back, I kind of want to get into a discussion of some of the threats that you see, and certainly you've presaged them right there. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford, and for those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope you continue to listen to KZSU and continue to support the station at Stanford. So we're back with Jonathan, and let's with that iteration of the internet as and technology as it exists today, as embodied by the iPhone and how Apple handles it. Perhaps that is a nice segue into, as a general matter, what you see as the threats to the internet based upon the values that you believe should be there.
Sorry, say that once more.
The threats that you see to the internet based upon those values that you believe should exist in the technology in 2008.
Well, the biggest threats come from ourselves in a certain way, in that our own rational decisions, as our generative technologies start to betray us and get less and less reliable, as still others out there are trying to subvert them, our rational move will be towards information appliances, either towards substituting one application at a time, things like the iPhone for our PC, or towards locking down the PC itself. And we see the leading edge of this in corporate environments, where to add that screensaver with flying toasters, you can't just do that anymore. The IT department wisely has it locked down so that the machine doesn't end up getting a virus or something. And then you have to produce some justification as to why you want to run new software. That, I worry, ends up compromising the values that have been so important, including the values of innovation on the one hand and of freedom on the other. And I try in later chapters about the middle of the book to paint the picture as to how we could get to a place where innovation has slowed down a lot and where we get interesting new forms of surveillance, either through these tethered appliances like the iPhone or through web services. Give me that browser and now I'll do my coding for the Facebook apps rather than for a Windows machine or a Mac, through those instrumentalities. And a couple examples that I use in the book are of a little-known case called TiVo versus EchoStar. EchoStar makes dish systems, satellite dish systems for TV that built in DVR functionality so you could record the shows that worked an awful lot like TiVo. TiVo sued them for patent infringement, and TiVo won. So, all right, so far a run-of-the-mill case. EchoStar owes TiVo $90 million. But then TiVo asks for more and gets it. They get an order from the judge telling EchoStar that they have to do an update to the EchoStar boxes out there, all but a handful, frying them, disabling the DVR functionality. That's a remedy that's sort of trivial from a legal point of view. Hey, it's infringing the patent, and pound it. Kind of like if there were a factory full of mousetraps that had been found to be infringing the patent, you would seize them. But it's also a huge sea change in the level of regulability. Those mousetraps are in people's houses. You, the patent police aren't going to come one house at a time and demand to see the mice. It's much more easy to do that when you have functionality like the EchoStar box and like so many other of these things, these internet appliances, tethered to their vendors who can update them. I think of it almost by analogy to a toaster you might have in your kitchen. You come down one morning, it says, congratulations, there's the winter update. It has a third slot. You're like, well, I guess I'm happy about that. The next day you come back and it's gone. Sorry, there were problems with the winter update. We've rolled it back. And then it's making orange juice a week later. At that point, it's like, what did I buy? Did I buy a toaster? I guess I bought a relationship with a company that's going to give me a better breakfast. And I think that kind of contingency is both helpful. It might introduce orange juice to people who didn't previously have it, but also new enough and sort of malleable enough that we shouldn't just let it creep in without thinking about it. Another example that I use of that kind of malleability is with a case called the Company versus the United States, in which the FBI got in touch with one of the car services companies kind of like OnStar, where you've got GPS functionality in the car and a button you can press in the rearview mirror if you run into trouble and say, help, help, I need help, and then they send help. So the FBI asked the OnStar or equivalent people to reprogram the system so that the microphone was simply on at all times in a car containing people of interest to them. And the company did it. So you get into the car, you're just driving around, the microphone is on, the FBI listening to everything. And the company objected to this and sued, lost at the district court, took it on appeal, won on the thinnest of reeds. The circuit court held that because the way the FBI asked to have it reprogrammed, if the bad guys got into trouble and pressed the help button, it would still only go to the FBI, presumably wouldn't help. That was not a kosher way to code it. But otherwise, it would be fine. And again, on one hand, you're like, well, you know, the FBI got a warrant, they followed the law, what's the problem here? On the other hand, it's so easy to see that kind of surveillance take place, and so few private parties are needed to make it so that the prospects for abuse, it's exactly the kind of thing the framers of the U.S. Constitution worried about. And I think it's a so-called horizontally portable technology. You start to think that, wow, off the assembly lines in China for Chinese citizens, there's cars rolling off the line with this functionality, mobile phones that can be listened into at any moment. And without going too far for the tinfoil hat, you realize that, again, our consumer decisions are leading us to an infrastructure of surveillance and control that is not a place we probably want to be. In Chapter 5 of the book, I make my best case as to why I think we don't want to be there.
Let's get to that in a moment. But in thinking about what you've just said, I think an interesting question that comes of it is whether consumers, in your view, are aware of these powers, as they were, or as they are, of the technology creators to do what you've described. In other words, certainly there are people like you describe who are attempting to hack the iPhone that are quite familiar. But what do you view, or what's your sense of the average consumer's knowledge of what you just described?
Oh, I think it's pretty low, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. I mean, the book is meant to be readable by somebody not steeped in technology and to help shape the market. I have a lot of suggestions in chapters 7 and 8, but many of them are basic market interventions. They're not saying the government needs to come in and do something. I just want people to be more aware of the edifice that they are casually building. And the more aware they are, the more the market may have to respond to say, here's a way of guaranteeing your privacy. This particular button will cut the mic off in the rearview mirror. And that simple tweak could make people feel much more comfortable with the technology, as long as they know enough to know that they shouldn't be comfortable with it in its current configuration.
We're in a political season, certainly, and when the show airs, it will certainly still be very much a political season. So I think given that, I do want to ask this question. We've discussed briefly consumers. What's your sense of who gets it, quote-unquote, in terms of our elected officials? And I'll you know, it's a broad question, but perhaps you could identify some people, perhaps in the U.S. and on the world stage, that you think are quite familiar with these issues.
Well, I've got to say, I don't think these issues percolate up much on the national scene. Mm-hmm. If I actually have to think about where the action is, where is stuff really going on that could affect our future, it would be in things like municipal Wi-Fi, cities trying to think of internet services like a utility, and how easily can they get the city wired so that anybody that wants to get online can, and the political and technological barriers that they've faced in San Francisco and Philadelphia, elsewhere, trying to do that kind of thing. At the national level, I think there's been a lot less focus on it because it really isn't a lunch bucket issue, and it's not one in which many of the nerds and the entrepreneurs think there should be a technology policy per se, except in as much as it's, hey, just keep the hands off. We're gonna solve our problems ourselves. And that hasn't been such a bad approach for the past 15, 20, 25 years. The absence of an industrial policy, of a strong one, on infrastructure deployment for internet, I think, has been pretty good. And the areas in which government has intervened more, whether it's in regulation of the bells, in telephony, whether it's television and bandwidth allocation, has had, you know, a whole swath of problems associated with it. And I think that's why you may, among, say, the major U.S. presidential candidates right now, see differences in whether they have a technology platform or what they say, but I'm not sure much of it makes a big amount of difference. I think in some ways they asked some people to help them draft a platform, so they had one, but it's just not going to earn or lose votes.
Mm-hmm. And that certainly dovetails with the general view, and I concur with respect to the average consumer's knowledge of these issues. And so the book certainly does a good job of bringing these issues to the forefront. Let's discuss one of the major issues that you discuss in the book, and obviously that's relevant to where we are today, and that's the issue of net neutrality. And again, many listeners may be familiar with that term, but what is that in general terms, and what would you say is the status of the debate right now?
Well, I think it means different things to different people. Overall, it connotes a cluster of worries about internet service providers getting too clever, starting to discriminate among bits in ways that could disfavor some bits over others and mean that poor people or poor entrepreneurs won't be able to get their bits out to people who would otherwise want them. And they worry that it means that the companies might engage in anti-competitive behavior, that they could favor their own voice over internet protocol service over Skype because they can just make it so that Skype won't work. Google has been very much on the other side of this because they're a major content provider that uses lots of bandwidth and that wants to push data out to lots of people. And the prospect to them of being approached by an ISP and being told, hey, you're getting tons of data pushed out to our customers over our wires, and you're reaping tons of ad revenue from it, we want you to share it, share the wealth, or we won't deliver your bits. And hey, it's a free market. If you don't think that you care enough to deliver to our customers, then fine, our customers won't get Google. Now, of course, any ISP not letting their customers get to Google might find itself without many customers. On the other hand, you could see that ISP offering free internet service because it gets paid by other content providers to make their content available. And on one hand, I actually see the availability of lots of different business models, including a free internet connectivity, or even we'll pay you to use the internet in exchange for knowing that we'll collect some money from the people whose sites you visit. I'm not sure I want to ace out that possibility entirely. The only problem is that that's just one fall of the dice. Many other fall of the dice, if you don't have a network neutrality principle, entail a kind of televisionization of network connectivity, which all boils down to the fact that still for broadband, many people only have one choice or two choices, and that's just not enough to let them vote with their feet if one of their broadband service providers starts behaving in a way that the consumer doesn't like.
This issue in particular seems, at least more than most other technology issues, has at least gotten some press attention recently. And I'm curious on your view on this with respect to, you know, the basic question that you hear, which is, well, what's wrong ultimately from having levels of service? If I, living in Charlotte, North Carolina, get my internet service through a cable provider, and that cable provider says to me, well, I will offer you faster service in return for a premium. I know that there are different ways to define net neutrality, but what's wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with that?
I think many proponents of net neutrality don't worry about that. And I guess I should only speak for myself. That doesn't seem all that pernicious to me when it is that coarse-grained. I pay Comcast an extra $10 a month for some more upload speed and download speed. What it really means is that they have edited my modem, my cable modem. They've sent it a signal that says, okay, unthrottle a little bit. Kind of like that old calculator where there was a memory button underneath it was the version that didn't have memory, but they made the same circuit board. Mm-hmm. And if you pried off the top of the calculator, you could get memory. Or the laser printer configured to only do 4 pages a minute because it has a chip in it that slows it down. I don't begrudge Comcast doing that. That's a form of price discrimination that, you know, gives you different service for different prices. And in fact, the difference between dial-up and broadband, you pay more for broadband often than you would for dial-up, so more power to them. I guess the worries come in when they start discriminating for some kinds of services versus others. I mean, the first uses of video broadband online, this was not for, like, microsurgery. It was things like the Goldfish Bowl cam, or watch me while I work in my cubicle in Norway, or the wheel of cheese in England that's slowly ripening in Surrey. It's very popular. You can go watch the Surrey cheese ripen. People, like, you know, testify that they just love to watch it because it just feels so solid and stable to them. At one level, that's insane. The idea that bits are getting moved around the world at some expense to somebody that isn't fully recouped so that people can watch a cheese ripen, this is where often you see the market people saying, yeah, we need a market. We need to allocate scarce bandwidth. And when we do, only if people really want to see the cheese and are willing to pay for it should that happen. And I'm not so sure. I think that often the most important technologies develop in this whimsical way, and the ability to have goofy things and services become popular on their path to becoming crucial and central. If you eliminate the ability for people to do whimsical things because they realize they're going to have to pay for it in an extra kind of way, then those things will never become crucial. So I actually like the subsidy built in for playfulness that an untiered, loosely untiered net provides, even though I don't worry about end users paying a little bit more for better bandwidth.
Is intellectual property law, or how much is intellectual property law, it to blame for where we are today, for the culture, the internet culture, as it were, as embodied by how the iPhone can be used and not used today?
Yeah. So far, I got to say, it's a greater number of points in the battle between the open ethos of the net than for the intellectual property law people. If the music industry and the movie industry had any idea what was truly coming down the pike, they would have acted much faster and far more thoroughly. They would have had the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force to shut this thing down. Mm. They would have been there in 1977 when Steve Jobs introduced the reprogrammable PC to say, we're fighting this. There is no way. Or we're cutting a deal with you now, Steve Jobs. You want to put some fun stuff on your PC, some pictures perhaps, that we hold the copyright to? Let's talk about how to architect your box so it will respect copyright. They didn't. They didn't have the foresight to see that. And just around now, many of them are coming to the sad realization that they don't want to be swimming upstream on this. The fact that in America there's now the Amazon MP3 store tells me that you have major music publishers now willing to sell you tracks that you could put on BitTorrent in a heartbeat or share with your friends. And they're just going to, you know, hope that it comes out in the wash. Just as they're coming to that realization, it's true that the range of tethered appliances and web services that are eclipsing the PC, in my view, give them an opportunity to actually come back with a digital rights management kind of view. On Facebook, if you write an app, it has to have a copyright policy, and one that if your app on Facebook allows for the swapping of files, Facebook reserves the right to shut it down, even though from Facebook's point of view, I think it would be a form of tertiary copyright infringement because the application written by some guy allows two other people to infringe copyright, so that guy is a secondary infringer, which makes Facebook a tertiary infringer. But even so, there's a mechanism of control there not present on the standard PC. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be too bad because we do see the publishing industries starting to figure out that there are ways to make money. They clearly have to reconfigure. It may not be as much money, but there are ways to make money based on abundance rather than scarcity. And if they can do that, it will remove one of the tensions that has long occupied people who study cyber law, and suddenly make the publishers, just as Google is eager to have good bandwidth and to get a message out to people, it'll put the publishers in their camp. And I'm eager to see that happen, if at all possible.
We're talking to Professor Jonathan Zittrain of Harvard Law School, author of the book The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It from Yale University Press. Jonathan, we have only about 7 minutes or so left, 7 or 8 minutes. So the fairness of a radio interview is limited when I ask the following question. But we've talked a bit about generativity, and I think at this point it'd be good because you've certainly alluded to it a couple of times, and we should get into it. What do you see as ways to solve or to address, again, the issue as embodied by the iPhone situation, as at least a term that's used in the book, as appliancized, the world of the appliancized internet and appliancized technology? What do you see as the solutions? What do you describe in the book?
Well, in the book, I try to make the claim that the sorts of problems we see happening with the PC and the net, thanks to their generativity, their openness, are problems that happen with any generative system, including ones at the content and social layers. So that Wikipedia, after an initial spurt of success, where it starts as a mere experiment in a backwater without firm expectations of success, and then, wow, it really takes off, it ends up, thanks to its popularity, facing its first real problems as people come in to vandalize pages and such. So in some ways, I make the claim later in the book that we can borrow from some of the lessons learned the hard way by Wikipedia as to how to keep it fundamentally still generative. People can still pretty much walk up to any article and edit it without allowing it to get tanked by spammers and liars and public relations people. And part of it is giving people of good faith, knowing that there's still plenty of bad apples out there, people of good faith, the tools they need to expend a little bit of effort to keep their neighborhood cleaned up. And Wikipedia has some of these tricks. I think we could develop them for the PC and for the internet. So Harvard Law School and the Oxford Internet Institute have collaborated on a project called Stop Badware. One of the projects of Stop Badware is to develop software that people can download to their machines that radiates the machine's health, that says, here's the basic vital signs, anonymized, of the machine, and we make those available to others in the herd. And that way, if there is a problem, we actually have a bit of what Bill Gates called in a different context, a digital nervous system to know about it. I could consider running new software, and before I do, I could say something like, how many other machines in the herd have encountered this software? Mm-hmm. On average, do they get more happy or less happy when they run it? And I start to get a flavor so that I can make, according to my own risk profile as a consumer, a decision about whether or not I want to run that code. Mm-hmm. And similarly, another project we've been doing traces internet filtering worldwide. And we do it the hard way, the centralized way. We go and test in a number of countries what sites we can get to and what we can't. We want to set up a distributed software so people can download a Firefox toolbar. When they can't get to a site, they just click a button that says, why can't I get there from here? The act of asking that question, aggregated across lots of users, gives us a real hint at the answer, because we can see that a bunch of people in China are asking why they can't get to BBC, and no one else in the world is. That lets us infer something about where the block is taking place. It's technologies like these that let people not just treat the internet as a consumer would treat a product for which they are paying or a service for which they go by the hour, but rather realize it's a collective hallucination that they are contributing to and a community that they can be a part of. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of solutions that I think can make those appliances comparatively less attractive, because the internet will be that much more safe.
The book is The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. The author is Professor Jonathan Zittrain from Harvard Law School. In the remaining few minutes, Jonathan, given that you're a very busy author, I do, and you alluded to it earlier, I do want to ask you a little bit about the other book that you have coming out. What is that book about? And tell us a little bit more.
That book, co-authored and co-edited with Rafal Rosinski and John Palfrey and Ron Diebert, members of the OpenNet initiative is called Access Denied. And Access Denied is our report after several years of studying of the state of internet filtering around the world, filtering done by national governments, why they do it, how they do it, the legal frameworks they use, and ultimately what they're filtering, what's on the minds of people in China, the government in China or Saudi Arabia, as they're asking for websites to be blocked. And you can get much of the data, as with the other book, online. You can also buy it online.
Terrific. And also, I do want to mention one of the great projects you've been involved with is Chilling Effects, and I'm a huge admirer of it. Again, for listeners who aren't familiar, what is Chilling Effects?
Chilling Effects started in 1998 when a couple students of mine and I were talking about the fact that a lot of the action when something gets taken down on the web isn't because some court ordered it to be taken down. It's just because the people who took it down got a letter threatening them, and that we don't see that stuff happening under the radar. So we simply set up a website that allowed people to send in examples of cease and desist letters that they got and other threats so that we'd start to get some flavor of the shape and amount of the threats going on out there. We hit a milestone when Google agreed to start sending us copies of all the requests Google gets to take stuff out of their index, often for accusations of copyright infringement. Very frequently, Google will take stuff out of Google.com, and now the public has a way of knowing and studying what those requests are and, you know, what they don't know by going to Chilling Effects. Interestingly, Chilling Effects has gotten its own share of cease and desist letters, urging it to take down cease and desist letters. So far, Chilling Effects has not, and it has not been sued.
But it has posted those letters.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Professor Jonathan Zittrain, A Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, from Yale University Press. You've mentioned a few, but just as a general matter, for those people that want to learn more about you and your work, what resources can you recommend?
You can go to my website, which is www.myinitials, which are JZ, or if you're in Britain, JZ.org. The book website is www.futureoftheinter.net. And both of those sites have onward links to other research and media.
Jonathan, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I greatly appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much, Dave.
You've been listening to Hearsay Culture and our interview with Professor Jonathan Zittrain, author of the book The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, from Yale University Press. I'm very excited that Jonathan joined us today. It continues what hopefully will be a long tradition of discussing these cutting-edge technology issues with authors that are doing fascinating work in that area. And I continue to look forward to various guests that we're in the process of scheduling at Hearsay Culture, and that I look forward to interviewing over the course of the year. I am, at the moment, still booking guests for basically the fall. So if you have any suggestions of guests that should be on the show or people you think I should be interviewing, I do encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, dave@hearsayculture.com. And I generally like to hear from listeners anyway, telling me how I'm doing, what I could improve, what's going well, etc. So don't hesitate to shoot me emails. As always, you can access Hearsay Culture through a variety of mechanisms. You can access the show either by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all of the shows posted, as well as the upcoming schedule. Of course, you can listen to the show live, and that is the first time you'll hear the show, on KZSU-FM. You can go to kzsulive.stanford.edu and stream the show if you're not in the Bay Area, or certainly you can listen the traditional way if you live in the Bay Area. You can also find the podcast by going to the Center for Internet and Society's webpage or podcast page in iTunes by searching Center for Internet Society in the podcast search engine. Or lastly, you can subscribe to the RSS feed for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So there's a variety of ways to go about accessing the show. Additionally, I wanted to add that as I continue to book guests, I also want to consider topics or areas that I haven't covered that you would like to hear about. So not only individuals that might be on the show, but topics that you think are important and that we haven't discussed, and certainly there are many, I'd love to hear from you about. As I've indicated, and as you'll see on the schedule, There are a number of guests coming up, and the guests range in interest from business historians to technologists to lawyers to social historians and social commentators. So there is very little in terms of subject matter limitations on the show beyond generally technology and or intellectual property law. That being quite a broad area, I can't really imagine that any guests that suggested that don't fall broadly in there would be inappropriate for Hearsay Culture. So again, I encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thanks so much again for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I look forward to talking to you next week on Hearsay Culture. Have a great day, and please continue to listen to KZSU.